pick a circumstance that I consider to be the limit of what we might consider intersubjectivity, which is interspecies communication. It's one thing to talk about whether we can have access to the other minds of people. The question is, can we also have access to the minds of animals? What's interested me, I suppose, since my days at Duquesne, and we have that common heritage there, studying Husserl and Merleau-Ponty, what's interested me is the notion of empathy and how do we philosophically account for it and how can we thematize it when it's happening in our experience. Something else that's always interested me is that in the history of psychology, there have been primarily two perspectives perspectives that everything is reduced to. On the one hand, there's the interest in the first person singular experience. When we want to find out what would it be like to be an ape or a bat, there's a famous article by Thomas Nagel, what is it like to be a bat? We also want to know what would it be like to be schizophrenic or psychotic. That's what they developed the psychomimetic drugs for in the 30s. Jean-Paul Sartre was injected with mescaline back in the 30s. You know, this was a not uncommon procedure, and even Timothy Leary and that whole tradition of psychologists who were taking hallucinogens in order to have some personal private experience that would give them an understanding of what it was like, first person singular, to be schizophrenic. But the behaviorists all along objected to first person experience because it was inaccessible to anybody else. Only the person who experiences something knows what they're feeling or thinking or willing at that time. So behaviorism came up with a radical extreme to first-person experience, and they called it behaviorism or methodological behaviorism, which basically is methodological in the sense of saying, since we don't have access to the other person's mind, we can only study scientifically what is observable. And what is observable is behavior, but not behavior as you and I know it when we encounter each other and shake hands and smile at each other, but a kind of perspective on behavior that is clearly a third-person perspective, where you are a disinterested, non-participating other watching something happen in the behavioral field. So the alternatives for psychology was either to go the direction of psychoanalysis as a way of having access to the inner world of the individual, or behaviorism, which enabled us to only make statements that were disinterested, non-participatory, just describing what appears. With Merleau-Ponty's phenomenology, there's the possibility of reclaiming behavior for psychology without having to reduce behavior to third-person observations. He only touched on this in his essays in the 40s, for example, on film and gestalt psychology, where he made the comment that love and hate and other emotions don't exist in the private recesses of the individual, but are observable in the other's face, in their expressions, in their postures. What enables us to watch movies and decode what's being felt by the actor portraying the feelings of a character? It's our power, our capacity to look into someone else's face, to read their expressions, and immediately to understand on our side what's being expressed over there. More recently, there's been the development beginning in Italy in the mid-90s at the University of Parma with Vittorio Galeza, and I'm trying to think the other guy's name, who came up with this expression, mirror neurons. And what mirror neurons, you may have heard this stuff, it's big in the field of neurophenomenology now, but mirror neurons have been identified by fMRI technology. It began with studying rhesus monkeys who, when they would pick something up, I won't pick up the recorder, when they pick something up, a certain brain cell lights up on the MRI. When that same rhesus monkey observes somebody else picking something up, the same neuron lights up. They coined the expression mirror neurons because these neurons were sort of ambidextrous. They were working when the animal was doing something, but they were also working when the animal perceived someone else doing the same thing. They've also discovered, by the way, in recent years, that autistic children do not have these mirror neurons, and it may be a physiological way of beginning to understand the lack of empathy between the child and the mother, which the mother used to be blamed for. We know this is a total misnomer now. So anyway, this whole area, this in-between realm between the first person singular, which many philosophers and scientists would claim we don't have access to, seems to leave the scientific field of psychology with no other recourse than this objective, a purely objective third-person perspective. So what I've become interested in is how phenomenology opens up a third realm, and I've kind of, as a pet expression, began calling this second-person perspectivity. Before I did this myself, there was a guy named Evan Thompson, who's up at, I think, York University in Toronto, and he put out a book about 10 years ago, collected essays, that he called Between Ourselves, and the subtitle, if I remember, was Studies in Second-Person Awareness or Second-Person Consciousness. But they don't really develop the notion, but they use that expression, second person. I thought, well, this is maybe a good way to go, because when you're talking to college students and wanting to introduce psychology, any other field, any other university but those universities where humanistic and existential psychologists preside, and at the University of Dallas, we're all phenomenologists, but at every other university, they're completely reductionistic, behaviorist, cognitive behaviorist, physiological, behavioral ecology, all of these approaches that try to reduce the human person to an equation, y equals f of x, behavior is a function of the environment, or behavior is a function of the chemistry of the brain. And once you put the equation that is the basis for every chart, every graph you see in a science journal article, where you have a chart, you have an x-axis and a y-axis. The y-axis, the dependent variable, is always behavior or experience. And the x-axis in any graphic representation of a psychological study is always the independent variable, which is going to be some quality of the environment, the temperature of the room, or the amount of light in the room, or the color of the room, and whether it's whether that produces greater performance, greater memory, greater attention spans of students in the classroom. So the presumption of most all psychology today is that we can understand the psychological as the dependent variable, y, which is reducible by the equal sign to being nothing more than a function of the environment. And I like to, if I had a blackboard, I'd be writing that on the board, because I find it's a very useful thing to put on the board for students to see that that equal sign doesn't mean it's a little bit influenced by the environment or a lot. It means it's completely and only influenced or caused by the environment. That equation y equals f of x, which is a Cartesian equation for the analytic geometry of Cartesian coordinates, if you remember your high school math, that type of language doesn't have any room in it for action or an agent, for agentive behavior. So in psychology, as it's practiced most places around the world, behavior and experience is only a response to an environmental stimulus. You always see SR theory. Well, that R doesn't mean A for action. There's, you know, in philosophy, the word action implies an actor, and an actor is an agent, and an agent is a subject, and the subject has will. So where did that all go when psychology came along and started reducing the behavior of rats and then pigeons and then college sophomores eventually? Those are the three most studied organisms in behaviorism, when all the behaviors were reduced to just being a function of the environment. So that's the what I'm calling the third-person perspective in psychology, which was put forth as a methodological alternative, or a methodological, I should say, paradigm, because it has become paradigmatic in the field, to make up for the fact that we don't have access to what's happening in the other person's mind unless we're in an intimate relationship with them. And then even then, it's scary. Look at what Bergman, his film Persona, which I just showed the students, freaked them out last week, because in Bergman's Persona, made in 1966, which is based in part on his reading of Jung and Jean-Paul Sartre, heavily influenced that film, he's got a nurse and a mute actress who are interacting together, but you realize that much of what the nurse perceives in the actress is a complete projection, because the actress never speaks, and the nurse just uses her as a projection screen. So it becomes terrifying to Ingmar Bergman when he reflects on to what extent, and he loves to study this, Bergman himself, in married couples. Many of his films deal with married couples who either enter into collusion or into a fol à deux, I can't say French, but it's the folly of two, the madness of two, where two people, one person takes on the other person's craziness in order to be able to live with them. Really, yeah. So, all right, so that's just a little bit of backdrop of what I have to deal with as a psychologist. What is the field that I'm going to study and that's the ontological question, the what of psychology, but then more significant if you're going to be a psychologist, a scientist, is to the research question, how do I have access to this field? So the behavior says I only have access to the field of psychology through perception. But there's a whole other kind of access that we have that includes intuitive, imaginative, empathic, and feeling dimensions of life. We used to attribute this to gender differences, female intuition, that kind of thing. But Kant had already spoken of this with the notion of the Anschauung. In German, the word Anschauung, which is translated poorly as intuition, I say poorly because it implies something that we think we're doing when we're not really perceiving, when we're just kind of guessing, when we're, you know, going with our gut. But really, the word intuition in the German, Anschauung, means to look at. It means encountering. It means that you have actually personally encountered that which you are talking about. So when Kant talks about intuition, when the post-Kantian philosopher Edmund Husserl talks about acts of intuition, and when they talk about that what we're going to study has to be given to us intuitively, that doesn't mean given to us from the inside by means of some special knack for guessing. It means that we have to have developed and nurtured within ourselves a special knack for knowing, for seeing, for perceiving, and for encountering. So this paper is a long-winded preface, but this paper is really an exploration of the encountering between a human being and a bonobo at the Fort Worth Zoo, who, out of the luck of the draw one rainy day when I walked up there with my class, and said, oh darn, it's raining, and they were all huddled against the wall. I said, we're not going to get anything from this. So while I was talking to them about ape gestures and head-bobbing behavior among the apes, as I was doing that, I noticed one of them over there started nodding his head, and then he started going sideways. So while I was talking to the students, I started doing what he was doing, and before I knew it, he came running down and up to the side, and we got into this interaction together. And at one point, because I remembered from films I'd seen that bonobos are capable of communicating gesturally, I pointed to the glass window way the heck over on the other side, and then I disappeared behind the precipice and showed up at this glass window, and at that point he came walking up. He knew exactly where I was pointing to. And at that point we had about an hour-long interaction that was purely gestural, and that's the thing I threw up on YouTube that my students did. It was an hour and a half interaction where occasionally I said something. And the students make me look like Pinky Lee. Well, if you're not old enough to know, remember him from the 50s, Pee-wee Herman. I come across kind of like a manicky assistant professor somewhere who can't shut up. But that's because they condensed into 4.5 minutes, the only places in 90 minutes that I was speaking. So we'll start then. The title of this is Exploring the Other Within the We, Phenomenology with the Bonobo. In reading the texts of the early pioneers of animal psychology, such as Jakob von Uexküll, who I'll tell you more about in a moment, and Wolfgang Köhler, do you know these names at all? Well, you probably, maybe, von Uexküll is harder to come by. I encountered him when I was a freshman at Bucknell taking an honors lab in biology, and my professor was the world's foremost authority on the golden hamster, and she said, you know, if you want, why don't you go to the library and see if you can find some interesting, you know, early biologists from the early parts of the 20th century, because they often were writing in an interesting way. So I saw this name with these two umlauts in it. It is Uexküll. And I said, that looks weird. I'll look his stuff up. And it turned out he'd come up with this notion of the umwelt of the animal, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. So von Uexküll is one. He was read by Merleau-Ponty and by Heidegger. And the other, Wolfgang Köhler, was one of the original three or four from the Gestalt psychology school. That's K-O-E-H-L-E-R, or K-Umlaut O-H-L-E-R. Wolfgang Köhler emigrated from Germany to the United States and taught at the New School for a while. And he's written books like Gestalt Psychology. His first book was called The Mentality of Apes, 1921. And the first books by Jakob von Uexküll, also 1921, A Stroll Through the Worlds of Animals and Men. So I'm going to be going back to some of these texts and then discussing the philosophical implications. So what we have before us are the observations of people who approach the animal with a sense of personal involvement, that they might enter into the world of the animal. Right off the bat, this is not anything that you would learn in a biology class today. It's not anything you would learn in an ethology class or an animal behavior class. I think at my own university, the woman who teaches animal behavior would have a conniption fit if she knew that I was teaching the psychology students to empathize with the animals or to try to discover a bond happening between you and them. And I find the power of suggestion is really powerful. I take them to the Fort Worth Zoo. I show them these videos, and I say, I want you to go out there and find your animal, and you'll know when you find it, because you're going to enter into a communication with them. But I do the same thing at the Natural Sculpture Garden. I tell them, I want you to walk through here, or walk through the DMA, until you find a work of art that resonates with you. And somehow that word tends to work pedagogically, because by golly, they all end up discovering something, and sometimes tearfully will talk about how they discovered through their bodily presence to the animal or bodily presence to the sculpture. They realize what Merleau-Ponty meant when he said that the work of art is a gesture from the artist to the person. When I find someone who can't really resonate with anything in the DMA, and sometimes they're, Catholic school, some of these girls are uptight and don't want to, they just want to only think what they've been told to think. So finally I have to go upstairs and take them and show them a Georgia O'Keeffe. And one of my favorite Georgia O'Keeffes is, I think it's called Bare Limbs in Winter or something. And it's a tree stripped of its leaves, and if you look closely at it after a while, you notice that the trunks are kind of, together. And I'll stand them about 4 or 5 feet in front of it and just tell them to relax, give them a little hypnotic induction, go walk away. When I come back, they're usually beet red as they realize what they're looking at. And I say, I want you to describe for the report what you're feeling right now, where you're feeling it, and how you know what it is you think is being communicated to you. Because it's not a cogito inspecting data. It's a lived body that's perceiving the flesh of the world. And that's a very Merleau-Pontyan theme. So I begin, let's click to the next slide here. This is let's go down. Did Carl leave? Oh, there we go.
Here we go.
All right. So the first section of the paper is called Participatory Observation of the Animal World, the Early Pioneers. Conrad Lorenz, do you remember this guy?
Yeah.
The guy who was wearing galoshes and walked by a bunch of goslings that were just hatching, and they all followed him, and when they grew up, they tried to mate with him even, because they had imprinting, and he discovered the phenomenon of imprinting. Jakob von Uxkull, Wolfgang Kröller, and David Katz. I won't have time to go into Katz's work, but we're just going to focus on these two here in reverse order. So, click ahead to the next one. In his essay, Methods of Psychological Research with Apes, Wolfgang Kröller wrote, and you can click again and it should pop up, the farther we push the analysis in striving for a particular kind of objectivity, which is what all psychologists think they're doing, we've got to describe things objectively, the less we're inclined to call the description one of the behavior of apes, and the more it dissolves into purely physiological statements. But this is scarcely the intention of objective psychology, the aim of which would be fidelity to the object of description. And you click it again, something else will pop. If the subject matter of objective psychological observation disappears as soon as one tries to describe it analytically beyond a certain point, then there are realities in the animals investigated which are perceptible to us only in the total impression. That is, those impressions that we have at the outset when we stand face to face within the field of behavior that we might call a perceptual gestalt. So the total impression, a footnote, I'll tell you where this became interesting. I took a whole class to the Dallas Zoo, and we called the course Chimpanzee Politics, and I had the mammal zoologist there, Dr. Cynthia Bennett, teach our students how to do observations of chimps and what to look for and how to code it and how to describe the hair on end and the dung throwing and anal picking and, grimacing behaviors and threat behaviors and everything that they do. But she said to them, when you're finished doing your 15-minute observation, putting everything in code, see if you can't write, jot down at the bottom of the page what the animals are doing. Well, I found that profoundly ironic. And I talked to her about it later, and she said, yeah, my teacher's always made me leave all that stuff out. But without the narrative description, I don't know how to add up all that stuff to get what's happening. Because how can you tell the difference between an angry ape and a playful one? By counting the number of hairs that are standing up, and what kind of facial expression it's making. It's really hard to differentiate that. And it's interesting that these scientists rely upon everyday language and narrative description, because the narrative is the total impression. A narrative with a subject and a predicate. You don't have subject and predicate when you just check a box that says hair is standing on end. You don't even have the is there. But in a narrative, you have to say what you observe. And so that's what I think Curler meant by a total impression. And then he says, how is that possible? Indeed, how is it possible that the traditional scientific third-person point of view results in our losing sight of the subject matter of objective psychology? What is it that the third-person perspective fails to give us time and time again when we go to the encounter with our animal subjects, but also our human subjects? Curler continues, it will be assumed that something objective in the animal, which is the very subject matter of psychology, eludes observation if observation is directed to only the part processes, the hair standing on end, the how much the eye is open, you know, whether the ends of the lips are going up or down, just stuff that you can't figure out what it means. But here another problem arises and remains in the end to be solved. In what manner do the total processes in and on the body of the ape, in what manner do they produce impressions in our perception? Like, what's the phenomenology of perception? How do these perceptions take form? What is the nature and degree of the correspondence between what's happening out there in the field of behavior and what I am experiencing in my lived body? This is the methodological question then. What is the relationship between perception and behavior, between consciousness and nature? To use Husserl's language from his 1910 lecture course on empathy and intersubjectivity, how do we understand the appearing, because that's the term that Husserl uses. There are appearances, but the word appearing is when someone is kind of shining, even in the movie The Shining, that term, and Schauen in German, Anschauen, intuition, is really a shining forth. The appearing of the animal. How do we understand the appearing of the animal's psychic life within our own experience? And what must we do when we go to the encounter with an animal, with a painting, with another person, in order to facilitate this appearing of their inner life? Though the Innerleben in German and inner life in English is already a misnomer post-Cartesian, because the real term that's used in German is Seelenleben, which means the life of the soul, the life of the psyche. And we can click to the next slide. In this regard, both Husserl and Sartre agree empathy is the only attitude necessary for understanding. And that's a statement from The Idiot of the Family, Sartre's last and final long existential psychoanalysis of Gustave Flaubert. As early as 1910, Edmund Husserl claimed that empathy made possible, well, what he called a double reduction. You have to understand the term reduction sounds bad, sounds very scientific, but what reduction meant for Husserl was when I reduce the focus of my awareness to something. So the word reduction referred to the circumscribing of the field of what I'm observing. So his transcendental reduction is when I reduce my focus by bracketing the questions of what's happening in the world outside me and instead focus on my constituting acts. What am I doing while I am perceiving the painting? How am I being present to you in such a way that I can feel what I think you're feeling? So the reduction is, it really means a focusing. The double reduction that he spoke of was the possibility that when I perform phenomenological reflection, what's given to me is not only my own stream of consciousness, but the stream of consciousness of the other. It sounds almost transpersonal. A viewing within this appearing of the intentional field of the other. This is a very important point. The intentional field of the other is not the same thing as what the behaviorist calls the behavioral field. The behavioral field is understood by a behaviorist as just motion of a body in three-dimensional time and space. The intentional field of which Edmund Husserl spoke is something that transcends just motion and space. It means the expression of intentions on the part of the person, the organism, that tells me what it is directed towards or away from. Even the most primitive single-celled animal, if you put it in a liquid and start to heat the part of one side of the liquid to a point where it's no longer good for that organism, it will move away from that. A plant will move toward the light. Of course, I don't mean to imply a teleological explanation. I know that plant auxins, and there's a physiological explanation for that. But the point is that within the way we have evolved. There is this capacity that we have to move towards and away from things that are good or bad for us. And the phenomenologists use the construct intentionality to embrace this rather than causality to reduce it to just cause and effect. So you're looking at the same thing, but one person just sees something that's being made to happen. Oh, the animal couldn't do anything other than what it's doing right now because it's caused to do that by the environment and by its body. If it's dark in the room and I walk over to turn the light on, while my bones and sinews and muscles are dragging my body over to the wall, I might also be thinking, I better turn the light on to make it lighter in here. But my thinking I ought to turn the light on doesn't have anything to do with the fact that my body is moving over to the wall and turning the switch. I'm not even exaggerating. Skinner would say that what I'm thinking in acts of willing is simply a collateral byproduct of the stimulus response mechanism. That the behavior would take place even if I didn't think or intend to change the circumstances that I'm in. It's kind of crazy when you think about it. So one of the things that phenomenology does right off the bat is it says you want to add some value, you know, to use an economic term, value added here. What is the value added to the perceptual field by phenomenology over and against scientific reductionism? Well, the value that's added is that we see the world as a field of intentionality rather than as merely a field of causality. I remember taking a class in philosophy of science as a 20-year-old college junior, and the one thing I remember from that whole course, the take-home, was that the principle of causality is imposed on nature by the human mind. It's not discovered in nature, it's imposed on nature. So if we are imposing causality, we can certainly impose something better. And the better thing would be this intentionality. Wolfgang Köhler wrote, training is needed to observe as much as possible without subjective additions. It's needed just as much to afterwards describe properly only what was observed. The trouble with the behaviorists is that they only describe so little of what was observable because they only described what they could see with the naked eye, but not what one could see with the kind of inner perception that Franz Brentano, who was the teacher of Husserl, talked about. So it remained for Jakob von Uxkull to teach us more about how to observe. We can pop the next one and keep going. Yeah, von Uxkull, this is just a list of his books. The Umwelt and Innerwelt, let's go back up, yeah. Umwelt and Innerwelt, that's the environment and the inner world of animals. Streifzeuge durch die Umwelt, that's the wanderings or a stroll through the worlds of animals and men. A picture book of invisible worlds, that's my favorite, 1932. Von Uxkull's contribution to the history of animal psychology was his professed interest in how living beings subjectively perceive their environment and how this perception determines their behavior. Now I digress again. We may not make it through the whole paper, but I can't help here. I have two pets at home. One's name is Sparky, one name is Lily. And sometimes at night when I let them out, one is crawling up one bedpost and the other's crawling up the other. Sparky is a jungle carpet python. He's about 6 feet long, only about that thick in the middle, so it's not a Burmese thing. And Lily is a little bit thinner. She's part rock python, part jungle carpet. But one of the amazing things to do when you watch how a snake moves, because what you're watching is this phenomenology of perception. You're watching what von Uxkull called this synthesis of perceiving and acting. He ends up saying that each animal has a kind of dual world, the Merkwelt and the Wirkwelt. The Merkwelt is the world of perception, the Wirkwelt is the world of work, Wirk, action. When the snake is crawling up the tree or the bedpost, and you watch how he's got a brain that's like, he'd be lucky if his brain was that big, but his brain manages to figure out, and each one figures out differently. It's not like they're born with knowing how to crawl up a bedpost, because that I don't think the DNA, they had bedposts back when their DNA was evolving. But they figure out through perception and action. So as he moves a little bit, he knows how far to go because his eye tells him. Then he stops and he holds on and he kind of pulls the rest of himself up. And then as he does that, having just repositioned himself, he's now in a position to see something he couldn't see a moment before. At that point, continuing to see and direct himself up, he moves. So what you find is that our lived world as humans, and I would say the same of a fly, the same of a snake, the same of a dog, the same of a horse, every living organism acts only by means of a pure synthesis between our perceptual and locomotor abilities, between the afferent nerves, which bring in perceptions, and the efferent nerves, which effect muscular contractions. It's a double nervous system. So the afferent nerves and the efferent nerves joined at the spine and going up through the brainstem to the central organizing part of the brain are always working in concert. And of course, von Uexküll is a biologist and he knows this. So he's laying the foundations here for what Merleau-Ponty, the phenomenologist, is going to be reading these physiological accounts in order to enhance his understanding of even human behavior. According to von Uexküll's position, what we call the reality of the individual organism is not to be found outside and is not to be found inside. Here he's rejecting Descartes' dualism of inner and outer. And we can click to the next screen here. Rather, it manifests itself in Umwelten. Now, the word Umwelt, the word Welt means world. The word Umwelt literally means world around, and it's usually translated environment. But he used this term, he didn't coin it, but he used this word in the German language to specifically designate what he called subjective self-worlds. And he suggested that they were like in a bubble. He called them the subjective self-world bubbles. The very approach taken by von Uexküll to his Umwelt theory is arguably one that might require us to cultivate our powers of understanding in order to understand the animal world. He asserted in his classic essay, The Stroll Through the Worlds of Animals and Men, the rudiments of an approach that would later be taken up by Merleau-Ponty. So it's participatory observation. Okay, now we can go to the next slide. Participation is not therefore sympathetic to understanding or empathy, and depth psychology might well profit from a reconsideration of its use of the term empathy. Okay, we go to the next slide then. We no longer regard animals as mere machines, but as subjects whose essential activity consists of perceiving and acting. I went into that digression so you understand it's not just extra verbiage. The perceiving is the afferent nervous system, the acting is the efferent nervous system. Or it's founded in the Fundierung of the body, these two nervous systems. These different worlds, which are as manifold as the animals themselves, present to all nature lovers new lands of such wealth and beauty that a walk through them is well worthwhile, even though they unfold not to the physical eye, but only to the spiritual eye. So, reader, join us as we ramble through these worlds of wonder. And we click to the next page. He says, to do so, we set out on our journey on the meadow. What a perfect place, he says, to begin our study of animal world. To do so, we must first blow in transit a soap bubble around each creature to represent its own world, filled with the perceptions which it alone knows. When we ourselves then step into one of these bubbles, the familiar meadow is transformed. A new world comes into being. This we may call the phenomenal world, or the self-world of the animal. And here I just gave you the German. Those are the two worlds that make up the Umwelt: the perceptual world, the Merkwelt, the world of taking note, of perceiving, the effector world, the work world, the world of achievements, the world of action. So his lesson can be reduced to this. We need to preserve a sense of wonderment, a sense of the magical in our encounters with nature. So now we flip to the next slide, and this will be the phenomenological framework for understanding our access to animal life. So far, von Uexküll and Köhler are psychologists, biologists, studying the perceptual and locomotor systems of animals, and from those studies, trying to imagine what would it be like to be whatever animal you're looking at. Husserl's approach to intersubjectivity is grounded in his thesis that originally we experience both our bodies and the bodies of others, including both animals and humans, as expressive. Husserl describes a special kind of experience of the other, namely those situations where I experience the other as experiencing myself. And we can pop to the next slide here, I just realized, yeah. or I experience the other as experiencing myself. This kind of original reciprocal coexistence where I take over the other's objectifying apprehension of myself, which we were talking about earlier, the regards, Jean-Paul Sartre and Being and Nothingness as a whole, part three on being for others, and the first chapter is the look, the gaze, the regard of the other. How do I know that there are other people? Just look around. The moment you see someone looking at you, gazing at you, hell is other people. That's where that came from. If there is a hell, it's the hell of the way people snarl at us, grimace at us, frown at us, make us feel unwelcome, uninvited. This kind of original reciprocal coexistence where I take over, this is where my self-apprehension is mediated by the other and where I experience myself as other. This is of decisive importance for the constitution of an objective world. The absolute difference between self and other disappears. The other conceives of me as an other just as I conceive of him as a self. Husserl points out that to see another person, another human being, is to see somebody who is able to see you, someone who is similar to you in his or her seeing. Reciprocity, according to Husserl, is necessarily involved in our relations with others. To see the other requires that you see him or her as seeing. Our corporeality comprehends their corporeality. We grasp the final meaning of the other's behavior because our body can achieve the same goals as the bodies of others. This is going to, if we get time to show the video I brought, there are places in the interaction with the bonobo where he was really the primatologist and I was his subject. And what he's doing is testing to see if I can do what he can do. And after he goes through all these gestural things with his arms and then starts kicking the glass, and so I'm kicking, then he turns around, sticks his butt up against the glass and looks at me upside down, I'm doing the same thing. He's basically wanting to see, can this guy do the same thing that I'm doing? And on one trip, there's something that's disgusting that all apes do in zoos. It's called coprophagia. It basically means eating their excrement. And you'll often think that it's feeding time. When they roll up with something in their mouth, they'll be popping it out and popping it back in, popping it out and popping it back in. Fortunately, they're vegetarians. And it's not so bad, but it's not really what you think it is. So one time when I was ready for this, I had my assistant open up a Nutrageous bar for me, break it in half and stick it in my hand. And staring the bonobo in the face, I popped it in my mouth and popped it out and popped it in and popped it out. And he began jumping up and down. He was smiling. His lip went down. He was bobbing his head crazily because he'd never seen a human being engage in this before. He was astonished and he was in ecstasy and he was happy. It's like, you know, the movie Freaks, Google Gobble, we accept you, one of us, you know? Okay, you know what I'm talking about? Okay. While we cannot become others corporeally, we can become others through our intentions. In this sense, we can reach others through the manifest expressions which present themselves to us. Consciousness and its manifest expression are one with the other, one with ourselves. This, by the way, Maurice Apre was in a book called Projective Identification, where he was studying borderline syndrome patients and their uncanny ability to project into other people. There are indeed times when one is searching for an understanding of another person, and one's own attempts at spontaneous imitation don't so much express your understanding as much as accomplish it. I can remember working at the VA hospital in Pittsburgh with schizophrenic patients, and one of the guys I worked with was trying to talk to me about how one of them moved through the world. We were trying to understand what would it be like to be this guy, and we both started walking across the path outside the hospital building, the way the schizophrenic walked with this with arms that don't swing right. Of course, we looked like nutcases, I'm sure, because when we got there, we saw all these nurses looking at us through the window, and we were appearing like patients. But we were trying to imitate the way they moved to see if we could figure out what kind of an intentionality is this. It's not just the body movement, it's not just the facial physiognomy or even the tone of the voice that we imitate when we imitate somebody else. It's the attitude, it's the intentionality of the expression. If you ever watch Impressionists on TV, they don't really look like the person at all that they're imitating. But we all know the expression is the equivalent of this person imitating that one over there. And it's the same thing with chimps and baboons and gorillas. I know that I don't really look like a gorilla or baboon, although I can make a monkey out of myself in front of the students while I'm doing this, but I do know that baboons, mandrill baboons, when they want to threaten another male, they do this thing where they have big incisors, the lower bicuspids, and they'll move their head and their hair will start to stand on end, but they'll do this thing that shows off their incisors. Now, when I stand there going like this, I may not look like a mandrill baboon, but the mandrill baboon knows exactly what I'm doing. And I did do this at different zoos just to experiment. I was at San Francisco Zoo recently at a convention, and there I see this mandrill. I said, oh, this is going to be fun. So I kind of just give him some head bob behaviors and snarl like that. And all of a sudden, his hair is going up, and he turns his head 90 degrees to my line of vision, dislocates the jaw, opens it, and shows all of the incisors, closes, and then just sits there. And he's wanting to see if I move away. Which of course I do, to play the game. A few minutes later, someone said, I can't believe... No, that didn't. I said, watch, do it again. I'm giving that, and I'm into, and finally, a snarl. He does the same thing, and next thing I know, he's just again turning this way. Happened 3 times in 1.5 minutes. And usually you don't get those threat gestures from them. But when you enter into the field of gestural communication with them using their gestures, they know exactly what you're saying. They know exactly what you're meaning by what you're doing. If a horse could do the same thing, the gorilla or the baboon would probably respond to the horse the same way, only we don't find horses pretending to be monkeys. That's where humans have an edge there. I've never seen a cat pretend to be a dog or a dog pretend to be a cat. But I have seen a video of 2 bonobos at play, and 1 bonobo picks up the mask of the gorilla and puts it on and runs around chasing the other one, playing being the gorilla. Then the other one takes the mask off and puts it on his head and turns around and chases the other one. You won't find even chimpanzees doing this. Only the highest developed consciousness are capable of even having the idea to imitate someone completely other, to put on the mask of a gorilla and become a gorilla. A bonobo will do that. A chimpanzee won't. A cat and a dog won't do that. Okay. Stick your head there, one. We'll read this next slide. Okay, the next one. In seeking access to the experience of an animal, now I'm shifting from Husserl to Heidegger, we must first ask the substantive question concerning what kind of being the animal has such that they permit, resist, or possibly forbid any such self-transposition into them in each case of each animal. That's from the Fundamental Concepts of Metaphysics, a lecture course he gave between 29 and 30. We can flip ahead again. Heidegger writes, transposing oneself into this being means going along with what it is and how it is. Such going along with, and I think that's what's happening when I'm standing there looking at the bonobo and he's doing this and I'm doing this too. Such going along with means directly learning how it is with this being, discovering what it is like to be this being with which we are going along in this way. Now, the italicized, when you first encounter Heidegger, if you haven't read him before, there's a lot of italicized words, and he seems repetitive and redundant and even perseverating. But he's really trying to drive home with the italicized parts of what he's saying, the process of the relational. We look back, where is it? What is it like to be this being with whom or we are going along in this way? So he's always trying to put the arrow, the focus on the mode, the manner of being, the style of being. Consequently, this self-transposition does not mean actually putting oneself in the place of the other, or displacing the other in the process. Like, I'm not trying to put myself in the place of the bonobo, because I'm over here. He's addressing me. He's doing his whole thing, and I'm just keeping my eyes on his eyes, and while my eyes are fixed on him, my body is doing the rest. I'm not telling myself, like, do I have a mirror here? Okay, now what did he just do? His hand is it kind of like that? Is that what he's doing? I'm not stopping to do that. It's spontaneous. My eyes are fixed on his. The body does the rest. You all know this when you dance with someone, especially if you dance with someone who you've never danced with before. You don't need to have a dancing lesson. It's intercorporeality. Your bodies just kind of go together. On the contrary, it consists precisely in we ourselves being precisely ourselves, and only in this way first bringing about the possibility of ourselves being able to go along with the other being while remaining other with respect to it. Now, this is the key in what I'm going to be talking about as second person perspectivity, because if it was just a question of me fusing with your first person perspective or imagining myself to be you, I'd be fusing with you, I would lose my own center. But what Heidegger's talking about and Husserl's talking about and Merleau-Ponty's talking about is not fusing with the other, not ending up inside the other person. That's why Heidegger doesn't really like the term empathy too much, because Einfühlung means feeling my way into the other. But Heidegger's saying, no, but I'm staying here on my side of the encounter. But there's something resonating in me that's telling me something about what the other's experiencing. Next slide. And this is the term that Heidegger used, sich versetzen. It's a reflexive verb, so it means transposing oneself. In English, self-transposition. And I was, when I went to the Merleau-Ponty Circle in Oregon in 05, at the airport, I saw some guy carrying a book of Merleau-Ponty. I said, are you going to the conference? He said, yeah, he just finished his dissertation. And his dissertation was on this phenomenon of the reflexivity of the body. So I said, oh, then you can tell me, what is the French expression for sich versetzen? He said, oh, compagnon. Wasn't that amazing? I never knew. The word is much simpler in French. Companion is what it means in English, but the French word for our companion, compagnon, means to transpose oneself into the other person while remaining kind of companions to each other. So it's this we, and that's why the title of my talk is Experiencing the Other Within the We, because it's within the we where I maintain who I am and the other is still the other, but the other addresses me as his other. And that's what I'm calling a second person perspectivity. We might say, on the basis of such evidence, Heidegger rejects the concept of empathy because the term suggests that one must first feel our way into the other being in order to reach it. And this implies that we're outside in the first place. Rejecting the idea that we're somehow outside the realm of the animal leaves us, it would seem, with the idea that we dwell within a common realm with the animal. We might say that it's through the lived experience of identification with the behavior of another that we discover our common ground, which is the body gifted with intentions. To paraphrase Merleau-Ponty, the other's gestures furnish my own intentions with a visible realization. Identification is the proper term for this phenomenon, insofar as I see in the musculature of his arms, in the wiggly movements of his fingers, in the playful shoulder shrugging, and even in the facial expressions of exuberance in the bonobo, something of myself. I know these to be expressive movements and configurations, and not mere twitches and ticks, precisely because I am living in this shared moment of experience in which the other's expressions belong not to him alone, but to the two of us, because they're for me. They don't exist in themselves. The an sich is the in itself for someone. This is how I elaborate and expand upon von Uxkull's more rudimentary conceptualization of participatory observation. I think Heidegger was correct in seeing von Uxkull as a point of departure, if not a foundation, for phenomenological considerations of animality. Let me go to the next slide, and I'm just going to check to see where our time is. Okay. Our own bodily experience orients us to the behavior of the other, of the animal, and of course ourselves in the mirror, rather than to his or her consciousness. And this is Merleau-Ponty. Within my own situation, that of the other whom I am questioning makes its appearance, and in this bipolar phenomenon, I learn to know both myself and others. It's not a question of reducing his experiences to mine, or coinciding with him, or sticking to my own point of view, but of making explicit my experience and also his experience as it's conveyed to me in my own, and to understand one through the other. I'm going to cut ahead because I see I've probably tried your attention spans to the point of almost an hour here. Let's go to the next slide. There's the monkey in the mirror. That's the outside encounter. That's the little bonobo. I think it's Benjamin over at the Fort Worth Zoo. The reversibility of the flesh is a reflexive, visually and gesturally phenomenon, and not a reflective, intellectual one. To be able to understand an organism's behavioral activity, we must adopt the perspective of a witness. This is why Merleau-Ponty says we must reject that prejudice which makes inner realities out of love, hate, or anger, leaving them accessible only to one witness, the person who feels them. Anger, shame, hate, and love are not psychic facts hidden at the bottom of another's consciousness. They exist on this face or in those gestures, not hidden behind them. Next slide. Merleau-Ponty becomes here a champion of what we might call the second person point of view, reclaiming observation as our method from those who would call us introspectionists, and along with it, reclaiming behavior as the subject matter of psychology. And I think I'm going to not present the rest of the written portion of the paper, which is the last third, but let's go through some of these pictures. The mirroring of intentions, the absolute difference between self and other disappears, the other conceives of me as an other, just as I conceive of him as a self. That was from Husserl. This is the reflexivity that serves as an ontological ground for experiences such as empathy. We go to the next slide. That's just a close-up shot that a photographer sent me. I guess I didn't realize there was a crowd gathering at the zoo until my students were finally being kicked out of the way by, you know, suburban driving soccer moms bringing their little kids saying, "This is for the kids, what are you doing? Let me get in there." So, well, we happen to be having a class here, you know. Anyway, so some photographer showed up. That's how I got to end up meeting Jane Goodall, was someone who was a rep of the local Jane Goodall Institute saw me, and so this was many years ago. We got her to come visit us at the university. Next slide, improvisational comportment. Oh, yeah, I'm going to skip ahead just to this one little part here. A woman I got to know a little bit, Elizabeth Banky, proposes that we learn to speak from a style of improvisational comportment characterized by a thoroughly bodily reflexivity. She wishes to move within lived experiencing itself from a separative, subject-facing object type of experience to a more inclusive, connective mode. She suggests that we speak from within our life among animals, from shared situations in which we and the animals co-participate, from the lived experience of interspecies sociality, where it is not just I who looks at the animal, but the animal who looks at me. And that was a closer up to the mirror. Let me go to the next one. This was indoors on a different trip. That's actually the one that I got the video, which we probably won't see, but let's see what's after that. Yeah. It's hard to get the face. Also, this is Merleau-Ponty. All zoology assumes from our side a methodical empathy into animal behavior with the participation of the animal in our perceptive life and the participation of our perceptive life in animality itself. And the next one. That's Sparky and Lily. When I get up in the morning, they're in their little habitat, and when I walk up, no matter how long they've got their 6 feet worth of coils, they'll always have their heads side by side, this way, that way, on top of each other. They always have their heads. And they know how to orient themselves to each other by the patterns and forms on their body, because they're visual cues. They know what's up and down, what's the head and what's the tail. Like, you never find them head to tail, ever. That's just something they wouldn't do. It would be rude, I guess, you know. So, you know, and there's the bonobo. That's the one when I got a good photograph of his face. And this is Merleau-Ponty's term, the chiasm. That was a moment many years ago, around the mid-90s, when I first encountered this guy. And at the very last moment when I was leaving, and he looked like he was pouting, he looked sad, the audience, the crowd went, oh, all at once, because I realized it's kind of cruel to make friends and then just to disappear on your terms. So I stuck around to kind of make amends, and then leaned in toward the window, and he put his hands up against it, and he pressed his face against it. So we pressed our faces against the mirror for a moment, and I called that the chiasm. And I think the last one I threw in for the fun of it, I got to go to Antarctica and discovered a whole other realm of the flesh of the world. This was on the southern tip, the northern tip of the Antarctic Peninsula. But the story of the penguins is a whole other story, so we'll just pause there. All right, we'll take questions, and please keep them short and succinct and respect our speaker's time and the ability to give, hopefully,
a response and answer? Well, I know we will. Okay, so we have a question here.
Have you read any of Paul Shepherd's work on Neoteny?
Oh, Neoteny, yes. Excuse me, I didn't
know. The way that you neotenize a species is you breed them for tameness, which is interspecies empathy.
Yes, exactly.
So if you develop this interspecies empathy among generations, if you breed for tameness, eventually the animals become domestic animals. Mm-hmm. Neoteny is different between a wolf and a dog, or between a Neanderthal and us. At the same time that wolves turned into dogs, we turned into us. And he writes about this in his book, The Others, How Animals Made Us Human.
Mm-hmm. I've not read him, but I know of his work, and I've seen the pictures comparing the infant chimpanzees to the infant humans. And is this what you did? The
right, and we are essentially hominids that never grow up.
Right.
So a neotenized modern human is called Down syndrome. So in effect, we are Down syndrome Neanderthals. But you'll notice that Down syndrome people are very empathetic for others. They're very, very tame mm-hmm. people. And if you breed for tameness, that's what you end up with. It's what differentiates all domestic animals from the wild animals is this process of breeding for tameness.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take one over here. One over here. Okay, over there.
Have you seen the movie Transformers?
No, not that one. I'm a movie critic, but I go to 150 a year, but somehow I managed not to see Transformers. Is that the one that's all CGI? I'm old-fashioned. I like light and shadow, so I don't go to much computer graphic films.
The movie Ripley.
Everything transforms. They're leaping machines.
No, there's some of the movie that's all 3D, most recently out.
Avatar.
Avatar.
Oh, I saw the twice, yeah.
Okay. What you're talking about is so prevalent in Avatars that I wonder if you have any students that are beginning to get interested in the topic because of
well, what do you mean that it's in Avatars? You mean that when people are playing, because you can go to computer websites where you pick an avatar for yourself to perform through.
Yes, and you become the other. Have you looked at that process?
No, not yet. I mean, I haven't gone there yet, no. Because the other, because first of all, if you mean become, you mean the other person you're playing with, or do you mean you become the avatar? That you become the intentions of this creature, this three-dimensional, non-three-dimensional virtual being isn't a real other, of course. It's being channeled by you, so that's the thing. Well, I mean, do you believe that in the field of the cyberspace, another being comes into being? I don't know. I mean, even in the movie, the avatar only existed as the extension of the person who closes the door and goes in and is all hooked up and basically is the central nervous system for the avatar. So
until the end, the tree makes it part of the universe.
Yeah. Right, a similar ending to 2001 where the star child becomes part of the universe. Yeah. Anyway, I see that as a kind of transpersonal phenomenon, a little bit different from this because it's not dealing with another person or another being. It's an extension of my own being, and the only thing that happens at the end is that when I die, I get to stay on the other side of the screen. Or like in Woody Allen's Purple Rose of Cairo, Mia Farrow had the choice of going into the movie screen and living with the character or staying on the real side and trying to know the actor. And the choice between the real and the virtual. So that's a different kind of question, but yeah.
But your program here shows a beginning of the thought process that takes place when a person tries to leave themselves and interact mm-hmm. as an other.
Yeah, what I found interesting in Avatar was the idea of through the avatar encountering another species or encountering another being. For me, the interesting encounter was the encounter between the Marine who had paralysis of the legs, who was laying in the avatar machine as the central nervous system, the directing the body, which when they turned it off, the body collapses, so it's not another being. It's like a costume that you're putting on, and through it you're able to move around and see the other real, not avatar, but the real beings that live there, and interact with them. So what would interest me would be, how could I, if I were to inhabit the skin of a cyber avatar, and in that skin could see in cyberspace the avatar of another person, how might we interact? You in your avatar machine on another planet, me in my avatar machine here, and our two avatars interacting with each other. But that still comes down to you and me, except we're seeing each other through these cyber forms. And yes, that would be interesting to get into the realm of the cyber phenomenology. Can we enter into second person, we experience two virtual beings, but I don't think that we're virtual as long as we're powered by two real people. So it collapses into the
correct.
Yes, there's a reality there someplace, isn't there?
You mentioned that the bonobo was able to pretend and put on this mask to be a gorilla, and the chimpanzees weren't, and implied that they were perhaps superior to the other species of apes in that way. Now, classically, I've heard that the chimpanzee was the one with the highest IQ, and also that they had, I believe there was data on identifying words with human words.
Yeah, that was 50s and 60s, yeah.
The chimpanzee, the gorilla was the top on that. Now, are we looking at just different measuring, depending on what you measure, you come out with one superior in this area, one superior
no,
in that area?
No, the bonobos are clearly superior. When I was a kid, when you went to the Smithsonian, they had the picture of the gorilla was our closest relative, and then chimps and orangutans. That's all been reconfigured through Jane Goodall, that chimpanzees were closer than the gorilla. But one thing that Jane, and I love her, I mean, I've gotten to know her, she's been doing this for 40 years, but there's such competition for funds that all the time she knew the bonobos existed, but she only ever talked about common chimps, which are pan troglodytes. Bonobos are pan paniscus. It used to be thought of as a subspecies, like back in the 20s.
It's called pygmy chimpanzees.
But pygmy chimpanzees, and they still sometimes are called that, but the pygmy chimpanzee or the bonobo by any other name, pan paniscus, is recognized as a separate species. It was Sue Savage Rumbaugh from Georgia State, who now she's out in Iowa somewhere with lots of money funding this. She's the one who was doing experiments with human children, chimpanzees, and bonobos, because they happen to have some there. And they were trying to teach chimpanzees and bonobos to communicate using lexigrams, which are abstract symbols that don't resemble in any way what the word is supposed to be. One day, and they spent all this time trying to teach this female who was 12 years old language, but they didn't heed Conrad Lorenz's notion of the critical period in which imprinting takes place. One day, a lab person says to the other person, hey, will you go switch on the light? Kanzie, the two-year-old child of the mother who's being taught the lexigram, hops off the mother's back, runs over, and turns the light switch off, and comes running back over. And they were dumbfounded. It had been learning all along what they were trying to teach the bonobo. To give you one quick demonstration of the difference between what a chimp can do and what a bonobo can do, one of the experiments they want to see is, can they process auditory information of sounds of words and see, transform the sound of the word, which comes into our left brain through the corpus callosum, goes to the right brain, and that's where we can, if you say, show me a glass, and I look and I go like this, show me a glass comes into my ear, processed from the left side of the brain. If I have a split brain, because I'm a seizure patient, and they've lasered it in half, and I'm looking through like this, and I see the word glass, I can't find it on the other side because there's nothing communicating from one side to the other. So, I've seen this with Sherman and Austin, the names of two common chimpanzees. They got a whole bunch of photographs. They got headphones on. Sherman, show me the glass. Sherman, show me the napkin. Sherman, show me the spoon. And they're showing the pictures of everything that's wrong. Kanzie puts them on. When he hops there, they don't have to put them on his head. He takes them and puts them on right away like a teenager. Kanzie, show me the spoon. Kanzie, show me the glass. Every single one, every single time. This is how they demonstrated that the organic development of the brain of the bonobo is so far superior to the brain of the common chimpanzee The common chimpanzee cannot process verbal information and recognize it visually, like in words or lexigrams or images of things. But the bonobo is capable of working both sides of that. And they're way far advanced of anything else. The only other animals that are as advanced as a bonobo would be like dolphins and whales. We're only just now beginning to know
how Rodney, you had a question.
I was reading about how elephants will mourn the loss of a companion. Can you talk about that as far as bonobos? And can you also address, related to that, whether or not there's any evidence that bonobos are aware of their own mortality?
I don't know that any animal is aware of its own mortality except for us, and I've never seen bonobos encounter death, but one of the most moving documentaries, and you can probably get this on Netflix, is called People of the Forest, and it's filmed directed by Jane Goodall's former husband, Hugo Van Lawick, who is the National Geographic photographer who was sent by Louis Leakey both to take pictures and also to hook up with her, and so they got married, and he made this movie, and there's a scene, the whole film is done under the premise of it being an anthropological study of the people. Then you learn right away with Donald Sutherland's voiceover that the people of the forest, we call them chimpanzees, and they show you a picture of Fifi at 25 years old, and they do a Dave Letterman, let me think back to that, and it gets kind of weird. And there you see her sitting in the same position, the same attitude, but when she's five, and you follow the next 20 years in the family life of Fifi, it culminates with the mother of Fifi, Flo. When Flo's body was found in the water, she's 55 years old and she died, there's a flies around it. But her little son, Flint, who was like a spoiled brat and he would not leave her side and he would fight with her because he didn't want to be weaned when there was a new infant. And finally when the new infant died, she just capitulated and let this 5-6-year-old chimpanzee nurse at her breast. When the mother died, Flint stayed by her body in a tree and wouldn't leave. And the video is the most moving thing I've ever seen, because there's not a dry eye in the house in the university when the students see this. And I love this because the religious side of the university wants to say that animals are here for our dominion, we should kill animals and use them, and blah, 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 blah. But once they see this, they realize that animals have souls. There's a moment where you see slowly lumbering in the leaders, the alpha males, and then the females, and the whole community comes in and they sit. And they're paying their respects. Of course, that's the voiceover. But what's provocative about the voiceover is you believe and see and understand and confirm these anthropomorphisms as you're watching it. Because what else are they doing? They're not foraging for food. They're not, sneaking up, let's grab some termites while we're here and snack. They're sitting in silence for a long time. And then, at a certain moment, one gets up and starts walking out. It's like one at a time. They look at her and they go and they leave. And all of them left. And the voiceover ends with Donald Sutherland's voice saying, "Only Flint stayed behind. He remained at his mother's side for 2 weeks and died of grief." And then it just fades. And then you hear all the sniffling in the room. But that's the only thing I know about chimpanzees observing death. But watch the video.
Yeah. Let me move over here, son. Right here.
Are you aware of, I'm not sure what we can do for primate species, but there's an experiment, kind of a cruel one, where they put a couple of these primates in a little cage separated by a clear barrier with sound holes through it. And when one would reach for food, they would get the food, but it would cause the other one to be shocked. And vice versa. And they did this with two primates that knew each other, and then when they out of sympathy, that's assumed sympathy, they would not reach for food. They basically would starve themselves to death.
Right.
Or near death. And then they put the original hypothesis was, well, this was because only because they had established relationship. But then they put two strangers in and same experiment, same behavior.
I don't know the particular study, but it doesn't surprise me at all. Aside from troop differences between common chimpanzees, where they will cannibalize each other in terms of their territorial behavior, chimpanzees that are raised in captivity for the purpose of experiment, I don't mean bad experiments like know, where they're cutting them open, but behavioral experiments, they have not grown up and learned and interiorized group differences, so there's a solidarity among primates in general. Unless they're in the wild and it becomes a matter of territorial issues, then that's very different. But they're much kinder by disposition than humans would be. I mean, when social psychologists give female college sophomores a chance to shock other female students hiding behind a mask so that there's anonymity, when they study, like the Milgram obedience study, they're also studying how long they keep their finger on the button that's administering what they think is a shock. And female college students, if a male college student is going to be the one shocking the female for making a mistake, sometimes males will fudge it and not really shock them, or they'll do it so fast, it's just like a nanosecond. You put a female behind the mask, and she sees one of her competitors out there, and they just ride that. It was shocking, literally. But bonobos don't do that.
Right here.
Oh, the bonobo is the pygmy chimpanzee, Pan paniscus. Only in Zaire, the Republic of the Congo now.
Central Africa.
There was 100,000 estimated left in 1990. About 10,000 left in 2000. We're guessing maybe 5,000 to 6,000 left now, because in all those years they're hunted for meat. They're hunted for bushmeat. Zaire was the poorest of all of the African countries. I think Jane told me this, so I don't know if it's a fact, but she said it. And then I think the name changed, and I don't know my political geography well, so I don't know when the name changed from Zaire to the Republic of the Congo, but that's where they are. They share territory with gorillas.
All right, over here.
How does the size of the cortex of the bonobo compare to chimpanzees? Is it much larger?
I don't think so. I don't know. I'm not good with physical anthropology, so I don't. Yeah, I think brains, like whether you're big or little, brains are pretty much like, if you're a big guy, doesn't mean you got a gigantic brain. So I think that the brains are pretty constant, and I don't think it's that much. I think it's more the connections within the brain, because we don't use all of our brain, and maybe we have lots of possibilities.
Well, you know, like we've got 10 to 11 powers that are on, and we have connections and all that. I just wondered how
yeah.
the elbow compared to that.
I don't know. Yeah.
All right, do we have one more question in the green shirt? You get the last word.
Yeah. Have there been any attempts to teach bonobos for kids, like mathematical concepts, and learning habits, they might understand numbers?
I am certain that someone has tried that, because it's one of the first things they do with the animal experimentation, to see if they have a concept of number. Back in the 19th century, Clever Hans was the horse who could count and do adding and subtracting, until they discovered later, looking at the films, that unwittingly, the owner of Clever Hans was giving some kind, you know how they in poker they call it a tell? There was a tell when you know, they'd say, add two and two together. You know, and he's looking at it, and the guy would blink his eye or something, you know, he would know to stop, you know.
So. I'm sure H&R Block has tried.
Yeah.
Okay, Scott, thank you very much.